This is an interview with Alden Naranjo, who now lives in Ignacio, Colorado. Alden has worked for the past 30 years with the Ute Tribal Police, as well as with the Bureau of Indian Affairs Law Enforcement Division, and is now a tribal historian for the Ute. This interview is being conducted at the Education Center in Ignacio on the 27th of March, 1995. The interviewer is Chris Blair, representing the Center of Southwest Studies at Fort Lewis College, Durango.
Well, let's see, I became a tribal police officer in about 1963, I think it was July of 1963, for the Southern Ute Tribe, and there was three of us then, the chief of police and I and another officer that consisted of the whole police department of this for the Southern Ute Tribe in 1963. 1965, we got a little bit bigger. We added another person onto it. But it was kind of an experience because at that time, for the whole year, I think we got how far we get.
Where the force was expanding a little bit.
Oh, yeah. Anyway, we come to about maybe, what did I say, four, another couple people at about 1965. And, you know, we had equipment that was fairly new. But we had some equipment that, you know, everything around here was all dirt road then, dirt and gravel road.
Yeah.
No pavements or anything like that. And Ignacio still had their marshal systems, you know, and we had our police department for the tribe. And we covered the area. You know, we didn't have no fishing game at that time. So we were the law enforcement for the Southern Ute Reservation, whether it consisted of fishing game or animal control and you know, family disturbances and helping out down here in town, you know, with some of their problems they had down here also. So we're just kind of, we started, there was, you know, that's the way we had it. Relationship with the town of Ignacio and also with the sheriff's department. The sheriff's department at that time had maybe three people in there also, you know. All the law enforcement agencies and offices around in this area during that time were relatively small. And we didn't have what you would call crimes nowadays or disturbances or, you know, people-to-people confrontations or anything like that. If they did, then, you know, they usually took care of them by themselves, you know. But nowadays, it's not like that anymore. You know, everybody's sued everybody, or everybody wants to go to court, you know,
yeah,
for one thing or another, you know. For them days, everything, you know, if you had a disagreement with your neighbor, you take care of it, you know. Or if you had a disagreement with somebody else, and people out in the bars had disagreement with their friends or people that they met in the bar, so they went in the back in the alley and duked it out and settled it there and went back inside, you know. after you got all settled. But they don't do that anymore, you know. Kind of one-on-one they used to have. But not anymore. But during that time, it was kind of a... we're just kind of been the peacekeepers, or just trying to keep, you know, keep anything that happened, you know, from escalating into anything else that was big. All federal crimes that was done at that time was taken care of by the FBI. The Bureau of Indian Affairs at that time also had special officers, they called them then. Now they call them criminal investigators, but during that time they had special officers. And their main job was, you know, suppression of alcohol or gambling or anything that was what was, you know, at that time. But 14 major crimes hadn't been established as been 14 major crimes that have happens on a reservation,
yeah,
such as robbery, murder, rape, or things like that, you know, hadn't been established yet. But BIA, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, law enforcement, their main job was just suppression of alcohol on the reservation and assisting us in investigation of anything that was major. But FBI took care of most of that. They took care of everything that came in. If somebody got, you know, killed or, you know, what considered a felony today, they take, came in and took care of that. And if it was anything major in the suppression of alcohol, then they took care of it also, you know. So they were the kind of a chief law enforcement people during that time. But we were just the initial first contact people. But as time went along, that changed. You know, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, law enforcement got a little bit more sophisticated. The Southern Ute Tribe, police department got a little bit more educated, I guess, you know, because at that particular time, no one had ever said that, you know, we had to go to a police academy, wherever it might be. And I guess during my time, because Southern Ute Police Department started around 1957-58. That's when they became their own police department. That's when they was established by tribal council. And nobody had ever gone to any academy at that particular time. Those that was in the police department, they were selected people that was, I guess, maybe just needed a job at that time.
Yeah.
The chief of police at that time, Charles Williams, was a non-Indian, and he had been a police officer, you know, prior to that, and also worked with the federal government in law enforcement, you know. So he was given that job of teaching his people how to be police officers, you know. So at that time, you know, all they did was, you know, give you your gun and your badge and, you know, some kind of a uniform and said, you know, here's the keys and you will work from 9 to 6 or, you know, 9 to 9 or whatever, 6. But at that time we worked from like 6 in the evening to 3 in the morning, you know. From 3 in the morning everything was closed, you know. That was kind of, we were kind of on call at that time.
Yeah.
We didn't have no dispatchers, you know, at that time. So our department at that time, the first time it opened up was down behind the Bureau of Indian Affairs office on the lower campus. There used to be a house down there, and that was the police department. It was a house, you know. No jail. We had an old jail that was that had been built back in the early 20s or 30s that sits back at the end of the street there. And it's basically a 20 by 20 building with, I think it had 2 cells and a bathroom and a kind of a hallway in there. And that was the police department. I mean, that was a jail.
Yeah.
I mean, a concrete block's what it was, really, with, you know, rooms in there.
Yeah.
And really poor ventilation, no, you know, poor heat. And poor you know, sanitary facilities or anything like that. It was just really a place where you'd place drunks, you know, for the night and let them out in the morning. So that was our jail. Then they built that one up there by what we call, used to be the powerhouse. It was a little bit more elaborate, I guess you might call it, for that period of time, because it was just a long cement building, and it had, you know, spaces for the women and two large cells for men, you know. And that was kind of for a long term, a longer term, like 30 days, 60 days, you know, that they spent in there, you know. So, and also, you know, that was just, had a, you know, bathroom facilities, some shower, one shower, and bunk beds that was, you know, put in against the wall, and that was it. And that was, you know, and families couldn't visit them. If they came, you know, they talked to them from through the bars there, you know. So that was the other jail. So eventually they moved the police department under the Tribal Affairs Building. That was then became the police department and the jail combination together, which became a little bit more elaborate. We had a drunk tank in there, we had a kitchen and bathroom facilities, and you know, separate cells for the women and also for, you know, the men, and a kind of a room that would we could detain youth for maybe an hour or so, you know, but nothing longer than that, you know.
Yeah.
So that was the police department that I went into right there. And we had an old Jeep, you know, that was one of them old square type Jeeps, you know. That was a police car. That and a old four wheel drive Suburban. That was the two cars that we had, and had radio in there, but the dirt road, you'd be driving down the road, dirt road, you know, and we didn't have no, you know, contact with, you know, like, we didn't have no dispatcher at that time. So our basic contact was with the state police or state patrol in Durango. And if we needed their help, they would come out, you know, but they didn't have very many people around in and around Durango there at that time too, you know. But it was kind of a, you know, it was kind of a entry into the society, I guess, or entry into the learning process for law enforcement, I guess, during that particular time. And we had, you know, all this territory to cover, you know, between Bakersfield and Ignacio, the state line, and back over toward Pagosa and further and south of Durango. That was, you know, that's where the reservation is. And all this roads were basically dirt, gravel roads, and that was it. So our main concentration was just right in this area here, in the valley here. And if we got called over toward south of Durango, was an Indian involved, we went out there. If not, we just let this Sheriff's Department or the state police handle it, you know. Same with Archuleta County over there, you know. So they take care of most of those things over there for us, because we're, you know, we're understaffed, undermanned, no dispatch, nothing, you know.
Right.
So during that time, around 1967, I went to the New Mexico State Police Academy, and for 8 weeks, I think it was, eight, and it was 2.5 months down there, about 12 weeks down there with the state, the New Mexico State Police. You know, as a recruit, I guess you would call it, for the New Mexico State Police. So after graduation, you know, we got letters, you know, I and Everett Birch went there, you know. I and Arthur Weaver went there first, but he dropped out, and then we had a chance to get Everett Birch in there to fill that slot. So, but anyway, we graduated from the New Mexico State Police Academy in Santa Fe, or Glorieta, that's where they used to have their academy there. and as qualified police officers, so able to work and, you know, able to work if we needed to with the New Mexico State Police. You know, that was our training that we got, and I guess it was about the first month I got that training.
Did the state require you to do that, or by choice?
It was by choice, really. You know, cars, at that time, a lot of the, you know, like the Miranda riots, Escobedo and all that hadn't come in to, hadn't been passed by, you know, legislation yet. Hasn't been, you know, your violations of your civil rights. No. So after we went down there, because, you know, at that time, you know, you see, maybe, I don't know, maybe you've heard how the old police or the old cops used to handle it was, you know, was different then, you know. If you suspected somebody of breaking in or didn't have any kind of connection with any kind of violations of the law, you went there to that person, you took him downtown, and you questioned him.
Yeah,
you didn't have to give him his rights, you know, his civil rights. You know, you were the accused until you could prove yourself innocent. You know? So that's the way it used to be. But after going to the State Police Academy down in New Mexico, we got letters, you know, saying that, you know, I got a letter saying that, you know, congratulations, you are now one of the state police officers in the state of New Mexico, you know, a letter from the Secretary of State.
Yeah.
And, you know, I guess you might call it wanting to go work with the New Mexico State Police at that time. Because I was qualified, I hadn't graduated from the, you know, from the academy, and I was able to do that. And I almost did. I almost did went to work for the New Mexico State Police. And, you know, during the time that we was getting close to our graduation down there, you know, several of the sergeants, captains, and people in the New Mexico State Police would come up to me and said, you know, why don't you just join us? You know, all you got to do is sign your name, and you've already, you're getting close to your graduation, and all you got to do is sign your name, so you're going to be one of the officers, and that will put you to work. But we don't know where it will put you, but you'll be somewhere, you know. You might end up in Deming, you might end up in Las Cruces, or you might end up in Farmington or Santa Fe or anywhere, Tucumcari or, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, that would be your duty station. Almost did. Almost made that transition into becoming a New Mexico State Police officer at that time. Sometimes, you know, later years, I kind of wished I had, but you know, I never did, so I kind of played around with it, maybe saying that maybe one of these days I'll do that, you know, but I never did. But I stayed with Southern Utah Tribal Police up until about 1968. And then at that time, in 68, I decided, you know, maybe I'll join the Colorado State Patrol. So I filled my application, went through all the interviews, and was accepted to their academy in Denver. You know. So I became a state patrol officer for a short time. Went to the academy, and during that time, it was all, you know, it was all Colorado State Patrol at that time was all basically white Anglo-Saxon Protestant people, you know, and they had no people of color or anything like that. They had no Hispanics, no blacks, no women, no American Indian or anybody like that, but it's all basically quite Anglo-Saxon Protestant people that worked in that state patrol. So, and it's about that time also that the minority, you have to have certain percentage of minority came into being, you know, had been passed by Congress, and they were required to hire so many Hispanics and so many Indians and, you know, blacks, but, you know, they had their way of screening them out also, too, you know, so as it ended up, I was the only American Indian, and I and maybe two other Hispanic people, and that was it. You know, that was basically the requirements of the state patrol at that time to be hired. And it was during that time, you know, when I found out, really found out about how racist people were. And it was just, you know, constant reminder that, you know, that we were less intelligent, you know, less capable of doing things than the other police officers or the patrol officers. And it was also during this time that, you know, Denver Post wanted to interview us and, you know, to see how we felt, like, you know, because this is, you know, Colorado history, you know, that the Colorado State Patrol has first time have ever done this within, since they were established. But there was a couple captains up there that told me and the two other Hispanics that, you know, that we were state patrol officers like everybody else, and we didn't need to be specially treated, or we didn't need to be interviewed, and we didn't need to be, you know, talked to or anything like that. Our pictures taken. We're going to take our pictures and take the rest of the, you know, class pictures or whatever. You know, and take that. But you know, you don't get no special treatment here, and you will never get special treatment here because you are people that are, you know, you came out and said, you know, you're not white. So I said, okay. We said, okay, you know, what can we do?
Yeah.
He said, if you do, said, you might as well pack your bags and hit the road, you know, basically like that, you know. But
we wouldn't even allow the interview to happen.
No interview came out, so we didn't interview. Yeah. So that's when I found out, you know, how racist people could be and how narrow-minded and, you know, the bigotry that was in the state patrol at that time, you know. But maybe it was just these two people, maybe it was just a few of them that was like that. But the way I took it was, you know, the whole organization and anything that had to do with white Anglo-Saxon Protestant within the state. And that's the way I took it. And I said, it's okay. I don't need to be here.
Yeah.
So I resigned, you know. So I quit. And came home and, you know, didn't have no job, so I just kind of hung around for a while. And then, you know, another opening came up with the tribal police department again, you know. But I said, well, you know, put in for it again. So I did, and I was hired again, you know. So this time I stayed with them a little bit longer, you know, from 1970. You know, this was in 68, for about a year and a half, and I didn't work anywhere. I just kind of worked odd jobs in there, you know. But in 1970, I went back to work with tribal police and worked with them until 1978. And things had gotten better, and they had established an Indian Police Academy, which I went to. That was in Roswell at that time, so I went there, and different officers had gone there. You know, that was the requirements then, you know, written into that all police officers within the Southern tribe will become police officers, and within a year's time they will take their So that was the story at that time. You know, so we went on, you know, working there, and it was kind of a requirement at that time, you know. So everybody had a working knowledge of enforcement, law enforcement then, you know, and you know, they were taught criminal justice, they were taught, you know, the procedures, and they were taught collection of evidence. There was taught a lot of things during the academy. The academy was run at that time by Indian police officers and also state police officers or visiting FBI or federal officers that would go to those academies and teach those classes, you know, their expertise, you know. So, you know, enforcement, law enforcement come to be a big business, like, and with the complexities of people's life, you know, because Escobedo and Miranda, your civil rights and all this had come into play and become law, you know. So you had to treat people with, you know, as people, not as what we call them, you know, people used to call them dirt bags or pukes or whatever, you know. They call them, treated them with some kind of respect, you know, as been people. And also, that time, you know, it became known that, you know, you were innocent until, you know, the law could prove you guilty then, you know, kind of a change around, you know. So, we had a good time. It was a good time. It was good times during that time. It was still, basically, people were still taking care of some of their own problems, but also people were beginning to find out that the court system was there in case that you needed it, you know. The judicial part of it was becoming more accessible to the people. You know, they were becoming, you know, more knowledgeable about how to, you know, proceed in criminal or civil matters. And if they needed to hire a lawyer, they could. If they needed to hire a lay counselor, they could, you know. But they were starting to do that. The people were starting to do that, and law enforcement becoming a little bit more sophisticated. You know, the collection of evidence and the forensic, you know, the parts of it, you know, that was there. The laboratory's been set up. You know, all this was coming into play. You know, FBI was beginning to be pushed out by the Bureau of Indian Affairs law enforcement. Special officers then. Name was being changed for them. They were becoming criminal investigators. You know, they were going to school in the criminal investigator schools by established by, you know, different federal agencies. You know, like the one in Glencoe, Georgia. You know, they have a big school down there that run by the Department of Treasury. You know, that encompasses all federal agencies that go to that school, become criminal investigators or whatever, you know, people that work with Customs and Bureau of Indian Affairs, Department of Interior, officers for the National Park Service and the Forest Service and you know, Internal Revenue, even some of the FBI people go there, you know, and BTF, you know, Bureau of Tobacco, Alcohol, and Firearms, you know, they all go there, you know. It was just, it's a big complex. And also, you know, there were people that were becoming enforcement officers. They were required to go to, you know, take some kind of college courses, you know, and also become, you know, more expert in expertise in their dealing with people, you know. These were all, you know, all coming to the police department over here also, you know. Town of Ignacio had become a police department then, no more marshals then. But we still worked with each other. Archuleta County Sheriff's Department got bigger. Durango, the Clyde County got bigger. Durango became a bigger department, you know. And this is the transition that was making within this area here. And the Bureau of Indian Affairs was, you know, expanding and hiring people, you know, to go to work for them, you know. In different parts of the country as police officers on the reservation, but has been as federal officers, you know, federal officer status. So I went to work. I went, while I was still here, I applied for the Bureau of Indian Affairs as a police officer over by in Blandon, Utah, White Mesa. And was interviewed, accepted, went to work there in 1978. In 79, I was working in Ute Mountain, Ute Reservation then. I'd become, you know, I'd quit the Bureau and went to work as acting chief of police for the Mountain Ute Tribe Police Department. And then, you know, there were several people that, you know, I was an acting person, but they were still open for, they were looking for somebody to become a police, chief of police there. So I applied for it also, and several other people, you know, applied for it. And I didn't get the job, but I was offered the job as a lieutenant for the, you know, for the police department. So I took that job, and I was there for a little over a year or a year and a half, something like that, to get. But in the meantime, I had also applied, reapplied for the Bureau of Indian Affairs in Nevada, or in the Phoenix area. So I was accepted to the Bureau, so I quit there and I moved. I moved to Nevada. Got a job in Nevada as being a lieutenant up there, the supervisor, police officer up there for the Bureau of Indian Affairs. So in 1980, I moved up to Nevada. And I stayed in Nevada till 1986, you know, when I worked as a supervisor police officer up there. You know, we had, you know, different small colonies, they call them up there, you know, which maybe one, two, three, four blocks, five blocks, whatever, however big it was. You know, those were the colonies within Elko, Nevada, is where I was, you know, where I had my duty station.